Today I would like to raise the issue of consent. Again, a little introductory statement. In medical ethics, we don't have a methodology of doing medical ethics, and we have to proceed by issues. And one of the major issues that is raised in discussions and in seminars on medical ethics is the issue of consent. Let me just mention what consent means first. When any patient is admitted into a hospital, he receives automatically a consent form. He has to sign a consent form which waives the hospital or physicians from liability in case anything should go wrong. That raises many problems already. I once was going to the medical center, to a hospital for just a dental checkup. There was nothing wrong with my teeth, but I had to sign a consent form. And the nurse gave me the form, it was a pink form, and said, "You must sign this, otherwise you can't get treated." And I said, "Just a minute. I don't think that's exactly the reason for signing the form. I teach medical ethics and specifically about consent, and so I knew a little bit about it, and I knew that that was not the reason for me to sign the consent form, but rather to relieve the hospital and the physicians from liability in case anything should go wrong. Not to be treated, of course. The treatment, freedom to treat is related to that. But that's not the immediate reason from signing the consent form. But patients sign automatically, because it's quite true what the nurse said, that you can't get treated without signing the consent form. So patients sign automatically, and the reason why they do that, again, is psychologically understandable, but should be explained. When a patient comes to a hospital, he comes as a patient, and he gives up his role as agent, and sociologists of medicine have talked about this a great deal. The word patient means that you suffer things, that you are no longer an agent in your own right, but rather a patient. You wait patiently for what the physician does, and you trust the physician that he is right. And that is a problem, because when you sign a consent form, you sign a form let me see whether I can explain it in different terms. When you sign a consent form, you sign it as a fully consenting adult who can understand what is going on. But when you understand what is going on, you don't give up your own volition. But that, in fact, you do when you become a patient. You give up your will and you surrender it to the physician. And all too often, patients say, "I have said this myself, doctor, you know best." And of course, this is very understandable. You know that the physician is the expert, and you know very little about it. So I was once, for example, I saw at the main desk at the Albany Medical Center Hospital, I saw a young man standing with his urine bottle. He had forgotten something in his registration, and he had already provided the urine specimen and carried that with him to the front desk in order to complete the registration process. That is somewhat humiliating, I suppose. Because a big medical center is like a big hotel, where there are many people milling around all the time. So the whole question of consent is very much overshadowed by the issue of freedom of volition, which is given up, which is surrendered as soon as you enter the patient role. Another problem is that when patients are supposed to give consent not only for treatment, but for example, if there is a more severe kind of treatment, like for example an operation, then physicians tell them about the situation, but in order to procure consent, they they want to do the procedure. So they tell the patient in order to be able to get the consent. And here is where the situation becomes, again, rather difficult. I remember one young physician in a German hospital who had just graduated from medical school and had to get permission from parents for their child to have a spinal tap, as it is called in ordinary usage. A spinal tap is sometimes necessary in order to be able to determine what condition the spinal fluid has, and physicians can tell a great deal about the state of the patient. So under certain circumstances, a not undangerous spinal tap has to be performed, not only on children and babies, but rather also on adults. And in this particular instance, the young physician had to ask the parents for a spinal tap to be performed on their child. And he went in to a little conference room with the parents and told them everything, every little detail about the spinal tap. The parents didn't give consent. What does the physician want? The physician wants two things. He wants to inform completely, but he also wants to gain consent. So this is a ticklish situation. You must be a diplomat in the better sense of the term, not a diplomat who tries to, you know, hide something, but a diplomat who is very careful and very capable in the use of words in order to achieve a certain end. Now, what is the end that you want to achieve as a physician? You don't only want to achieve you don't only want to obtain consent for a certain thing to be done, but rather also you want to maintain the trust of the patient. Paul Ramsey, who is probably one of the leading spokesmen in medical ethics now, says that the whole principle of consent revolves around the fidelity relationship. He also uses another theological term: a covenant relationship between patient and physician exists. And of course, these terms he obtains out of the Old and New Testament. Just as God has made a covenant with man, so also there should be a covenant relationship between man and man, and specifically between one kind of man, namely a physician who has power over the patient. Here, just like God has power over man, here the covenant relationship of trust is especially important. And you must act within that covenant relationship. That means that under certain circumstances, I think you might be able to withhold information if the patient isn't capable of dealing with it as yet. But at the end of the conversation, which may go over days or weeks, if it is a very serious thing, at the end, like for example sterilization, I think is not a minor thing to talk about, sterilization of men or women. Here also informed consent has to be given. And the conversation would have to be carried on in such a way that information is not simply put on the table like a bag of potatoes, but rather you want to be careful. You want to wrap the information into nice packages so that it is digestible. Now, so much for general observations about the consent principle. However, the consent principle gains special relevance in the context of human experimentation. And here, really, the consent principle becomes of cardinal importance. And there are certain instances of human experimentation which are especially significant. The circumstances which are of special relevance are consent for experimentation on children or minors, or another subgroup which has become in recent years a major form, in fact a political issue of the first order, consent for experimentation on fetuses. So proxy consent for minors, experimentation for proxy consent on minors, on children, and it's another category which perhaps should be treated separately altogether, proxy consent, that is consent for fetuses. unborn fetuses or born fetuses, and this is usually treated as one category. Another special case is experimentation on mental patients. Perhaps I should mention again that since the Nuremberg trials, the world has become quite aware of the special protection that mental patients need. You may perhaps remember that there was one man at the Bethel, perhaps I don't know how it is pronounced here, the Bethel asylums, Bodo Schwing, was the director of those asylums in Germany. When the Nazi thugs tried to storm in there to drag out the mental patients so that they could be exterminated or could be, prior to doing that, experimented with. And the horrors of that, of course, is still in our memory. Again, we should say that as children need special protection because they cannot give informed consent, so mental patients also. Another category under the issue of human experimentation is prisoners. To what degree are prisoners capable of giving informed consent? Prison is one kind of a total institution, just like a mental hospital is. And again, I should add, perhaps as a little subnote to the previous category of mental patients, that we must not assume that all mental patients are so deranged that they don't understand what is going on. Frequently, they are highly intelligent, but there's something wrong with them. They are not in full control of themselves and of their environment as most of us are. So also prisoners. Prisoners are usually in full control of their mental powers. But the question is whether the consent that they may give for experimentation is perhaps something that they use as a leverage to be able to be set free. As a matter of fact, that usually is the case. The question is whether that is legitimate. The question is whether that is an adequate, informed, and free consent for such experimentation. The American Medical Association has set up guidelines for experimentation with humans with specific reference to humans that are in some way incapacitated. Prisoners, mental patients, children, and fetuses. Now, it is very interesting that the American Medical Association The American Medical Association does limit experimentation on such individuals that are minors or prisoners or mental patients or unconscious patients, any person who is in any way incapacitated from his normal mental control. But the American Medical Association guidelines do not eliminate such experimentation. Now, there are many advocates who say that experimentation on anyone who is not in control of is a complete, mature, adult mental powers should not be experimented with. Paul Ramsey, for example, is an advocate of such a position. Again, I must say, the reason why. Individuals who are not in control of their mental powers need special protection. Take little babies. We usually, in our culture, treat them as a special case. They must be cared for in every little detail. It must be seen to that they sleep properly and that they get their proper food, and somebody must be around them all the time. And when some catastrophe happens, we usually save babies and their mothers first. And for that reason, Ramsey says that consent for children and for fetuses, consent for experimentation on children or on fetuses cannot be given at all. Now, that may be a radical opinion. Maybe you think that that is a radical opinion. And I would like the discussion to center around that question. Formulate the question and then explain myself a little bit more in detail. It may be a radical opinion to limit experimentation only to mature adults because the benefit that may be derived from such experimentation on fetuses, for example, or on children, may be able to help mankind in future generations. Now, this is also the reason why Ramsey wants to limit experimentation only to such fully consenting adults. Because he says, if we are going to have experimentation on humans, it must, and on especially with regard to experimentation on children or on fetuses, we cannot have any such research except that therapeutic benefit is derived from such research for the individual on whom the research is being conducted, and not for future generations. He says that's an abstract consideration which should not infringe on the rights of the individual himself. Now, opinions diverge here, because mainly physicians are against Ramsey's strict rule. And the reason why physicians are opposed to Ramsey's strict limitation is because they say, okay, experimentation on children or on fetuses is usually of such an order that we can determine the degree of risk. We can determine the degree of risk. And we can also determine the degree of benefit of future knowledge, of knowledge which may benefit future generations. We can also say what harm might be derived to the individual himself, with a certain level of probability. This is the opinion of physicians. And Ramsey says, okay, that may be very well true, but it's only a matter of degree. You cannot say for certain that no harm will be derived from this experimentation. And for that reason, because we cannot eliminate any possibility of harm altogether, Ramsey says experimentation on children and on fetuses should be eliminated altogether. Yes?
If that's Ramsey's position, he might be a bit inconsistent in that setting up the classes of children, fetuses, etc. might become arbitrary, in that adults are not altogether fully mature and free to make consent in all cases.
Yes, you're quite right. Ramsey, I think, says, in fact, in some instance, that informed consent is, from a certain point of view, impossible. And this is said again and again. I forgot where I read that first. Fully informed consent is really an impossibility because of the dynamics which I have tried to explain at the very beginning. But Ramsey does make a distinction, and I would agree with him there. There is a qualitative distinction between the more or less mature consent which an adult can give and the other kind of consent which a minor might give, which indeed is very problematical.
You have a question over here.
I was trying to put this together, and I'm not sure I've got all formulated in my mind, but with getting a consent, does Ramsey also address himself to the mentally ill or just to the babies?
No, mentally ill too, yes.
Because I was thinking if it's meant, like there's medication and therapy, I don't know what all is involved, but for treating the mentally ill, it would be hard to experiment on that on someone who was already okay and they were not mentally ill. How would you experiment on the already all right when it's pertaining to the mentally ill, and at the same time you couldn't get a consent from them in order to experiment with new drugs and so forth to help the mentally ill? How does he
I don't know whether I understand your question altogether.
I'm not sure I understand.
Yes.
I think your
comment let me see whether I understood it correctly. Certain drugs need to be experimented with on mental patients.
Well, I would think so.
Yes.
I wouldn't want to be experimenting myself, say, on someone who was a schizophrenic.
I wouldn't
want to take the experimentation for them.
Because yeah, that's right. Because you are not a mental patient.
Right.
Yes. Okay. Yes. That in fact is the crux of the matter. Let me illustrate also with the question of fetuses. It is known that in syphilitic mothers who are pregnant, the disease goes over to the fetus. Now we know also through experiments, incidentally, we know that penicillin is the drug of choice to treat syphilitic pregnant women, and the baby that is going to be born is treated at the same process. We know through experimentation with penicillin that the placenta is permeable to penicillin. Now, we also know that some women have a penicillin incompatibility, that some women, some people cannot tolerate penicillin. So, you must find another drug. Now, you must experiment with that drug, whether the other drug, erythromycin, I think it is called, was later on through experimentation determined, you must determine through experiments whether another drug is also going through the placenta. And it turned out that erythromycin was such a drug, but only through human experimentation was it possible. Now, Ramsey would say that no such experimentation can take place because the degree of risk is too great. We don't know how this new drug what that will do to the whole organism of the mother and also to the fetus, and therefore we should not conduct such experiments. Such experiments, in fact, have been carried on, and today, in such circumstances, whether there is a penicillin incompatibility, erythromycin is given. But we would never know that unless we would have done experimentation. Now, I would like to put these two opinions very... I think you're quite right, in other words. I think you're quite right that certain drugs need to be experimented with on the patients that have actually that condition. And I would perhaps not have quite such a rigid position, and I would be... I guess I would have to carry the label of being inconsistent. I would like to be consistent with Ramsey in saying that the dignity of the individual has the highest possible status in our treatment. But I would have to be inconsistent with that. I would not want to go so far as to eliminate all experimentation on minors and on fetuses and on babies.
Because I can understand, but life in itself is a risk. It's like coming into the Holden dock and getting on the bus, and if any of you have been here before and you're coming in the second time, you know this round is going to say, well, the mechanic hasn't checked that engine going up the mountain yet today down here, that I better have this checked before we get on. I mean, I wouldn't want just willy-nilly anybody lined up and giving medication to take the risk, but life is a risk. You take all kinds of things, and if I had an illness which it was still an experimental stage to find a diagnosis for and to find treatment for, I think that I would be inclined to take all kinds of experimental drugs and so forth to see if it couldn't help.
As a consenting adult, you would, yes.
Right.
But not as a...
But if you had a child that had something that was not... I would need help in some of these. I know certain cases of leukemia that are just really deadly.
That's a good
example. If you had a child with leukemia and you knew that child was going to be dead within a matter of months, couldn't you do anything?
Exactly. Leukemia, I think, is an especially good example because most drugs that are used in leukemia that are now commonly used and are considered to have therapeutic effect have once been experimental in nature. In addition to that, ever so often, I don't know how often, new drugs are being developed, which are themselves, of course, experimental in nature at the beginning. And they are put on the market and they are being used. And it turns out that in many cases they have a positive effect. Yes.
Can I clarify one point? According to Ramsey, the mature adult permission, is this given to himself, or can a mature adult give permission for someone in his family who might be a fetus or a baby or a mentally ill person?
No, this was the point of what I wanted to say, and in fact I think I said it, but maybe I didn't say it clearly enough. Ramsey does not permit proxy consent. Yes. He says that no such, as the American Medical Association in fact does, the AMA guidelines for consent on for experimentation on minors, on mental patients, permit some experimentation which has intended therapeutic effect for the individual on whom the experiment is being performed. But Ramsey does not permit any such experimentation.
In other words, Ramsey denies certain patients, like children, a kind of treatment that could save them and could be of benefit.
Right.
I don't think that.
Because of the minimal.
Go ahead with that.
Yes, because of the minimal element of risk involved, you see.
But, yes.
You've got a proxy consent then, Ramsey, though. Parents would give proxy consent for all kinds of surgery for their children and all sorts of other things. It would only be in the case of experimentation.
That's right.
That seems to be also a very arbitrary and not very consistent distinction. Because there are risks, every child that has an appendectomy or tonsillectomy or who knows what it is,
yes.
There are risks involved, the parents give consent for that. I suppose the very nature of experimentation is it wouldn't be experiment if you knew exactly what's going to happen ahead of time. You're not quite sure
maybe
exactly what's going to happen, and there are degrees of risk, and that seems extremely arbitrary.
Yes.
Should also clarify what experimentation means in Ramsey's sense. If he talks about experimentation, I don't know what he includes into experimentation. Maybe you can explain that.
Well, you know, after the Supreme Court ruling of 1973, fetuses became available en masse for experimental purposes, and the medical profession just had a heyday, because all of a sudden, it was possible through legal means to obtain fetuses. Now, at that point, the moralists who had been dealing with medical ethical issues, of course, became quite concerned. The Peel Committee in England at first got quite incensed about the issue. I think in Britain there was a abortion ruling somewhat earlier than our own, and it became known that fetuses were being sold to medical centers for experimental purposes, and the English press, of course, gobbled that up, and it became a big issue, an explosive issue in the parliament. And then a so-called Peel Committee was established under the guidance of a man called Peel, and the English Peel Committee guidelines were set up. Our own country developed its own in the Department of Health, Education and Welfare. Set up a committee which was to study the feasibility of research on fetuses. And Ramsey had not a minor influence. He himself was not on the committee, but he had major influence in the committee's formulations, because some of his students were in fact on the committee, like Karen LeBax. And now The question is what kind of research is permissible? The guidelines which were proposed by the committee did not permit non-therapeutic research on fetuses. The promulgation of the actual guidelines then by Caspar Weinberger, I think is his name, who is the head of the Department of Health, Education and Welfare, deviated from that. He permitted some degree of non-therapeutic experimentation to enter in again, thereby giving the medical profession again a certain freedom which they had had before. But the guidelines themselves are more restrictive than they had been before. Yes, the question, you know, you must make up your own mind, I think. It is very important. Do you understand the individual to be more communal oriented? Or do you understand the individual to have an absolute right in his own, apart from any communal obligation? That, I think, is a basic question. Do we, in fact, have obligations for future generations to make certain sacrifices or to be expected? I think this is the way it should be formulated, to be expected to make certain sacrifices for future generations. Even with our, and for such sacrifices to be demanded of us, even without our consent. That is, I think, basically the question. Children cannot really be expected to give any mature consent. Adults can, I think, but not children, and certainly not fetuses. Yes?
It does seem rather inconsistent that, on the one hand, that a fetus apparently has no rights at all, it can be thrown in the incinerator,
right,
and so forth, but that you could not have any experimentation on it unless throwing the fetus in the incinerator is considered to be a form of mercy killing or something, and you don't want to torture the fetus in some sense.
Yep.
It certainly would seem that experimentation which would possibly benefit.
Yep. I want to say something about that in just a minute, but there was some other question. I want to say something about that in just a minute.
Your whole idea of consent in your presentation here, is it basically concerned with experimentation or those who are unable to weigh the facts, or is it with current medical practice where someone submits himself as a patient?
No, my main consideration, and in fact the main consideration of anyone who is concerned with these issues, centers around non-therapeutic research on minors or on mentally incapacitated people. Because, I mean, here is the ethical issue. There is no ethical issue, I think, in experimentation on a consenting adult. If you want to go now to some medical center, and if someone asks you to give consent to certain experimentation with drugs, and if you give that consent, there is no ethical issue there. But we are concerned with experimentation on minors who are in need of protection. That is where an ethical issue is. But somebody back here wanted to.
You were talking about fetuses, you know, dead fetuses, like aborted fetuses, and whether they should be experimented.
No. I mean, I can't really go into all of the ramifications right now. We don't have time for that.
Yeah.
Experimentation of fetuses does not only include the dead fetuses. That again is a relatively minor problem, but rather fetuses in utero. That's the one category. Then the fetus that is partially born, that is a fetus that is experimentation by, let's see whether I can reconstruct the word. I can't. If the fetus is doomed for abortion, then there is a certain procedure by means of which the fetus is retrieved out of the womb, but with all of the umbilical cord and everything still intact. And then you can, outside of the body, perform certain experiments with, for example, tap.
While it is still alive.
While it is still alive, exactly. Yes. Now, this kind of research is where the ethical issues revolve around. And I would like to mention an argument that Lowell had mentioned just a minute ago, which is indeed argued for by some rather significant people. Yes.
May I ask, is there a change of money involved if somebody said that they would experiment with a certain drug, would they get money for doing this?
I think this is largely no longer the case now because of the scandals that have in the past arisen.
Because I could see a big issue involved.
Yes.
with children, and,
yes,
and you were poor and you took your child in too.
Yes, that is the reason why generally the trend also for giving blood is away from giving blood for money. Let me mention this argument. Maybe this is the time to mention this argument. When the whole issue erupted, maybe a year and a half ago now, on fetal research, I would like to use this as a test case for the whole issue of consent as a whole, but because it is so political and so explosive right now, maybe it should be amplified somewhat. When the issue erupted about a year and a half ago, two people, Will Galen and Mark LaPay, have written an article in the Atlantic Monthly, which later on appeared also in the Hastings Center Report in modified version, on experimentation on fetuses. Now, Will Galen is the president of the Hastings Center, and Mark LaPay works there too, and Paul Ramsey works closely with them. I'm a fellow there too at the Hastings Center, and for that reason I know about these things. They have written in the Atlantic Monthly an article on experimentation on fetuses. Now, the argument runs this way. Since fetuses are doomed to die anyway, and since counted brutalities or unfathomable horrors are conducted in such killing of humans. Since a great wrong is being done, it is legitimate to get as much good out of that as possible. In other words, one wrong is somewhat righted by another wrong. This is the way Ramsey argues, that no wrong is righted by another wrong. Figure the Jews in the extermination camps in Germany. This is the way Ramsey argues now. Figure the Jews in the extermination camps in Germany. They are doomed to die anyway. Therefore, since they are subhuman anyway, it is okay to get as much good as possible out of this and to experiment with them. Ramsey argues also in another way, a person who is dying and who is perhaps in coma could perhaps be experimented with, these people argue. Ramsey says no. A person who is dying and who is in the process of dying should be permitted to die his death all the way out. That's a tough position, I must say. It's a tough position. It's more moral, I think. It is certainly more engaged from a Christian point of view, Ramsey's position. But therefore it is less reasonable. Yes? It's less reasonable. And the question is, how much reason shall we permit to intrude in our medical practice and in our human life generally?
Wouldn't it seem though, both of these cases, that the application of reason as well as Christian principle would say that the existence of the extermination camp for the Jews and the existence of the abortion of the fetuses were, to say the least, highly questioned. And that it pushes you back a step and say, should those fetuses be doomed to death in the first place?
Right. Certainly. But, you know, Ramsey has done all in his power to prevent such a ruling, yes? He is if there is any pro-lifer, you know, then it is Paul Ramsey. Okay, but now we have such a ruling, and we have mass abortions in our medical centers without any scruples at all. What are you going to do now? I mean, the thing is there. What are you going to do now? Rectify that one wrong by another wrong? I'm just arguing with Paul Ramsey, yes? I mean, I don't...
Try as best you can to modify that, as you indicated in conversation, it had been modified in Germany, I think in some reversal of the ruling, and perhaps also to do all in your power to prevent pregnancies which are unwanted.
Yeah, I'm in full agreement with you there. But the issue is whether experimentation on fetuses should be performed under these circumstances that we have unwanted pregnancies. You know, the thing that you would like to do is not the actuality. I would fully agree with you. We are in a situation, and I think the Christian always has the mandate upon him not to be guided by principles, by principles which might never become real, like, for example, a more reasonable approach towards preventing pregnancies, but rather to deal with the actualities, to have that degree of flexibility, to be under God's guidance, as we call it in ordinary Christian language. Being under God's guidance means that sometimes you have to do things that you would rather not want to be engaged in.
Isn't the restriction of research on the fetuses mainly a decision made by the politicians? And if that's true, isn't the politician's main concern not the right of the fetus as such, but rather the long-term results of what the research might produce? Weren't they mostly concerned with the direction the research was going in?
Neither one. They're resolving to public, reacting to public pressure.
Well, they are reacting to public
pressure is concerned about?
That's right. We should perhaps mention one particular case which also was quite explosive, well, the Edelin case, which happened in Massachusetts. And it's not a coincidence that Dr. Edelin was convicted of manslaughter on a grave robbing charge. He was convicted of manslaughter for doing experimentation on a fetus. The fetus was doomed to die, but this was the way the argument ran, but he took that fetus that was dying, or that was dead, I think it was probably a dead fetus. There the association with the grave came in. an old man, a grave robbing charge out of the past history of Massachusetts was unearthed in order to prosecute Dr. Edelin because he had done experimentation on an aborted dead fetus. And it's a political thing, sure, because there are many Catholics in Massachusetts who are very much against abortions in the first place, but secondly, if a person is dead, don't kick him, yes? That's the argument. You remember perhaps the atrocities that were committed in Israel when Palestinians threw bombs into orphanages and into hospitals, and some of them were killed. The Jews were so enraged that they burned them. And the rabbis came and said, look, this is not good Jewish practice. Even the dead should be honored. We have inherited that tradition. And this is the reason why the political pressure is put on such experimentation. Sure, it's political, highly political, but for that reason it is not illegitimate, I think. To the contrary, hopefully these issues do become political issues.
Would you speak to the what seems to me apparent that the Catholic Church vehemently is against abortion, even though Catholics are using abortion, but the Lutheran Church, for instance, is, you don't hear many vehement statements out of church people against abortion. It seems to me that our church, my church, is succumbing more to public pressure as the politician does. Could you just speak to that?
I think that is unfortunate.
Is it accurate?
Not accurate.
Well, I guess the gentleman is addressing himself to the supra-local church, to the political statements out of the church, and not only the local church. Isn't that right?
Right.
Yeah. Yes, I think your assessment is correct, but I think it is a problem. Now, I'm Presbyterian, and I don't know exactly what's going on in the Lutheran church, but I think that in the Lutheran church also there are, in theological circles, there's debate, as is going on in the Presbyterian Church also. And if you don't hear about it, this may partly be your own fault, I don't know. But there are committees of ethics. As a matter of fact, I know one, a colleague of mine, a student of Jim Gustafson, Merle Longwood, who teaches in Siena College in Loudonville in New York, has been on a committee to study the issues surrounding ethical issues surrounding life and death, and he is still that committee is still meeting, and he is ever so often he's flying off to Minneapolis because there they have their meetings, and such work is taking place. He is Lutheran. Such work is taking place, and it might be perhaps a good thing, to read up on the official church publications. Such information, I think, can be found in official church publications.
Before this closes, I realize you've been speaking to the moral and ethical viewpoint, but may I just question, because I'm not sure on the legal point of view, in these consent forms, are there consent forms that have been taken to court? Somebody will say, I'm thinking of perhaps an extreme case, but the lawyers will come and they'll say, well, I know you signed a consent form, but all you have to do is say, I didn't completely understand, so forth, or however they word it, and then the patient gets the case. Has there been a consent form that has been written which has held up in court? I have a feeling that they're all kind of willy-nilly. You sign them, but if you really wanted to sue, you could go ahead and do it anyway.
If a case comes to court, this is my feeling, if a case comes to court, then it is already, a public issue. Let me just mention the Quinlan case, which I'm sure every one of you have heard about and read about. In the Quinlan case, a document, as a matter of fact, was produced. The parents gave consent for the respirator to be stopped because the physicians asked for such a form in order that they might be protected. That was a wrong action. I'm convinced that a commentary that was written by a physician in the New York Times, which I read, is correct. Namely, that was the cardinal mistake that was made in that case. The physicians, as a matter of fact, already were no longer trusting the parents. And the parents were no longer trusting the physicians, but mainly the lack of trust was on the part of the physicians, which is understandable because of all of the malpractice dust that is being thrown up. They are afraid, and therefore they wanted to cover themselves, and they asked for the parents to give a consent form for the respirator to be stopped. Once they had it, however, they were fearful to actually execute that desire or that desire on the part of the parents, because they knew quite well that, as a matter of fact, as it happened, the case might go to court nonetheless, and it did. If no such document might have been produced, the case might have been one among other very similar cases. That happens all the time. But because of that document and because of the fear of the physicians, it had become a bigger thing. Certain documents were produced, they could be presented in court, you see, and for that reason the physicians were not willing to act on it. Now, it's somewhat different from what you asked, but I don't think consent forms mean very much ultimately.
Ultimately, it's what can be proved in court that was actually said between the patient and the physician. And the consent form is just a vehicle that may help or may not help.
There was some gentleman yesterday who said that he would, put out, he says, I won't sue you no matter what, but so far I've found none of those.
Well, the courts say that you cannot give consent ahead of knowing what that consent is for. So you cannot go to somebody and say, you can do what you want to me and I won't sue you.
Yes.
Because you don't know what he's going to do.
Yes.
So you can only give consent for something, and it's not only medicine, but anything.
Yes.
You can only give consent if you know what that consent is for. And
exactly.
That's why you can't, a patient can't do that with a doctor. You can't say that he won't sue no matter what.
And yes. Why do we sign all these consent forms?
Well, it gives some relief from liability, I think. It gives some relief from liability.
Honest people, honest.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I was going to continue here, and usually I have much more material than we need, but we have had some good discussion. I don't know whether we shall continue. How much more time do we have? We have no more time. Let me just mention, just in case you might be interested in continuing this at the next session, that this problem that we have centered around, this problem of consent which we have centered around the fetal research issue in this discussion, in fact, has much broader ramifications. And we could very conveniently ask ourselves at the next session whether experimental transplants are, for example, of kidneys. Once upon a time, kidney transplantation, and not too recently, heart transplantation was an experimental thing. In fact, heart transplants are still an experimental issue. And there are some very interesting cases out of the history of transplantation, kidney transplantation and heart transplantation in particular, which highlight the frailty of the consent issue. Because medicine has an independence all its own, as Al Pritchard made clear yesterday, that science, that out of the theology of Niebuhr, it never dawned on me precisely like that, but in fact probably Niebuhr's theology did foster a great deal of pluralism of interest. The medical community, especially the researching medical community, is one of such interest forces. And the question is whether the advance in medical science, and research in particular, should be automatically legitimated. Now, we know that through such transplantation experiments, in fact, it has become possible to perform transplants of kidneys, not of heart, but of kidneys. But I could give you, at the next session, if you want, some very interesting cases related to kidney transplants and heart transplants, which center around the consent issue.
I have a comment that, if I could add it here, it occurs to me that war is similar. That is, government leaders decide that there's a need for a war, there's a just war. It seems to me that's clearly declaring
that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Killing for yep. some greater good.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
And how does that differ?
Yes,
from
and not long ago we've had a draft. So the issue again is somewhat historical now because we don't have a draft anymore. But it's an excellent example which I always bring up in my classes. For I don't know how long we have had a draft system. And we required young men to sacrifice their life, if need be, yes? Mm-hmm. Some of them actually did sacrifice their life, maybe all too many, for the common good. And they were not asked, they were forced. And we expected this of everyone. Why can't we expect someone to make himself available for useful medical experimentation? It's a very good question, yes. I mean, no, we're talking not about adults, yes, but rather about children. Why can't we expect this as a common, as a contribution to the common good?
It's a they good were question. Required not only to sacrifice themselves, but also to kill others.
Right.
We're not, the That's intention right. of going into the army is not to get killed.
That's
the
right.
intention is to kill.
It's to kill, yes.
Occurs to me even that Jesus might have been a suicide, in it, if you want to push this.
Yes. 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 I have thought of that. I have thought of that. But just a quick answer to that remark. If Jesus had not died for us, we would not be saved. No other man can take Jesus' position. For that reason, Jesus is qualitatively different from anything that we do, and you cannot measure anything that Jesus does by any criteria. You can look at Jesus from a sociological perspective, at the early church, you can look from a sociological, from a psychological perspective, but if you explain all of these all of these occurrences and stories that we know about, and the saving event of Jesus Christ himself, by psychological or sociological criteria, you dilute, you eliminate, you explain away the redeeming factor of Jesus Christ. And for that reason, it is in some way interesting, but pointless, ultimately, theologically pointless, to make such analogies.
That really isn't Jesus' crucifixion, is hardly a suicide. It's called murder. And he commits himself to a way of love and is killed for that.
That's right. But, you know, as a matter of fact, that is one of the issues that I brought up earlier. I mentioned, I don't know whether you were here then, I think there's a big turnover in this whole room all the time. Parsons, Parker Parsons, who was mentioned yesterday also in a discussion. Parsons, René Fox, his student, and also Litz, whom I do not know, have written an article trying to theologically on the justify for some person to sacrifice himself for somebody else on the theological model of Jesus sacrificing ourselves. That is, when somebody else dies in the hospital, he dies the death in our stead, so that we are relieved thereby. Specifically, physicians are relieved so that they don't have to fear death, and can look death squarely in the eye and help a patient as best as can either to come back to life or to die a good death, but not be paralyzed by the fear of death. You know, there's a strong, we have talked in previous sessions, in the first session, major session that we have conducted here, on the basic fear of death that prevails in hospitals. And these three sociologists have written an article on the vicariousness of death, that is, when other people die a death, they die for us in the hospital specifically. They die a death for us. It was very difficult for me to understand that at first. It's a point that is well taken, but that point could not be made unless Jesus Christ had first died this vicarious death for us. If he had not done that, then we couldn't die a vicarious death for others. And if Jesus Christ had not died on the cross for our sins, then we couldn't bear the sins of others either. You know, this is simply a theological statement which you cannot explain in any other way from sociological or from psychological or from philosophical dimensions. This is a theological statement which you must a priori make. You know, this is theology, the buttress of our faith, I think. Thank you.